This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Playing the percentages in international trade on the program today. Also, when things go bad in Silicon Valley, they go bad in a hurry. And from our man in Shanghai, water so toxic that it can kill you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you along on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 19th day of May. One of the through lines of the presidential primary so far on both sides of the aisle has been trade, free trade, to be precise, and the economic merits or lack thereof that free trade deals bring. As it happens, and as you may be aware, the White House is trying to get a big trade deal through Congress this year, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. And to that end, some news. The U.S. International Trade Commission says it's figured out how much economic growth the TPP would bring us. 0.15% by the year 2032. That is 0.15%. Tiny, right? So what's all the hubbub, bub? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson covers all things TPP for us.
0.15%. Yep, sounds tiny. But another way, it means an annual boost to GDP of nearly $43 billion, which sounds less tiny. We need some context here.
That's about a month or two of GDP growth.
Jared Bernstein is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a think tank. The report also estimated the TPP would add the equivalent of 128,000 jobs by 2032.
That would be a pretty disappointing month if we heard that on one of those monthly jobs reports. I mean, as my grandma would say, that's bupkis.
But Peter Petrie, a professor at Brandeis University, says don't forget how massive the U.S. economy is.
Look, the U.S. economy is like an ocean liner, and it dwarfs the impact of any single policy change.
He says gains from the TPP would be modest, but they're there, and the agreement's ready to go. Keep in mind, there are also parts of this agreement that just aren't captured in these numbers. Susan Ariel Aronson is a professor at George Washington University.
This is based on a model of where the economy might go. It can only accommodate estimates about things like manufacturing growth, but it can't accommodate things like technological change or labor rights and environmental provisions.
You have to think about the usefulness of the deal in other contexts.
Back to Jared Bernstein.
Geopolitics, trade relations with our partners, the role of China in the global economy, the way disputes are going to be settled between trading partners.
He says this is where you go to decide whether the agreement is good or bad. The focus on economic growth and jobs, it's more of a distraction. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The trials and tribulations of the retail sector have gotten a fair amount of airtime here lately. So, fair being fair, some good news today. This morning, Walmart posted earnings that beat expectations, something neither Macy's nor Nordstrom nor a whole slew of others have been able to manage. Blame has been put on tough competition from online sellers for retail's present doldrums, which is not wrong. But Walmart is also a giant in groceries, like half its revenue giant. So its grocery business could be thought of as a kind of a firewall against Amazon and the other all-digital competitors. Marketplace's Mark Garrison puts all of that together.
Be honest with me here. Are you the one at the grocery store Jengaing your way through a brown mountain of potatoes to get the best one, or debating with the deli clerk about proper ham thickness? It's okay. You're not alone. Most of us want to be in the store to see what we're buying for ourselves. Tom Coppernol follows retail for the consulting firm Deloitte.
Grocery shopping is personal, especially now with so much emphasis on fresh and healthy eating.
Online doesn't let us squeeze the fruit. It also doesn't let us swing by to get the one ingredient we forgot right now. Buying groceries online is hard for a lot of people to embrace, and selling them online is even harder for companies to pull off, including well-funded ones. It's a lot more complicated and expensive to ship eggs, milk, and chicken cutlets than, say, books in cardboard boxes. Meg Major follows the industry for Progressive Grocer.
Oh, the whole infrastructure of everything. I mean, temperature sensitive, storage, everything has to be really pristinely packed.
Not to mention that perishables have to arrive when the customer's home so the food doesn't spoil. Walmart's also using its brick-and-mortar grocery presence to build its online presence. Listen to what Walmart CEO Doug McMillon made a point of emphasizing in today's earnings conference call.
Our grocery pickup service in the U.S. continues to receive high marks from customers, and we're continuing to expand it.
It's a bit of both worlds. You order your groceries online and pick them up at the store, packed and ready to go when you are. The hope is Walmart will pick up additional business online and in stores. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Tell you what, I'm in the grocery store like 6 days a week. It's the truth. All right, down Third Avenue from where Mark filed that piece to the Financial District, then a couple of blocks west. All was not well on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Theranos used to be one of the hottest names in Silicon Valley. Theranos and its founder and CEO, Elizabeth Holmes, actually, were equally buzzy, due mostly to the company's near-revolutionary blood testing machine. In the past 6 months or so, though, a good part of that shine has worn off. Theranos' testing results have come under serious scrutiny, and there is a new and troubling development today. John Carreyrou has been leading the coverage of Theranos for The Wall Street Journal. John, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
What is it that Theranos has done, I guess this time, one could say?
Theranos has voided 2 entire years of test results that came from its proprietary testing device, which it has codenamed the Edison, after Thomas Edison, the famous inventor. And it's also sent out to patients and doctors tens of thousands of corrected reports. That number of corrected reports includes the Edison voidings, and it also includes voidings and revisions of test results for tests that were performed on regular machines purchased from the likes of Siemens.
It seems extraordinary on two levels. One, that the company has had to do this, but also just in the sheer scale of people who now have to go back to their doctors or to the hospital or whatever and deal with the ramifications of these bad tests.
It's so extraordinary that one laboratory scientist that I quoted in my story today thought that it was probably unprecedented. He made the point that there have been recalls of single tests by manufacturers of diagnostic equipment before, but never a recall of an entire platform of testing like this.
Does this mean that if I had a blood test done at Walgreens or something, I'm in some trouble? Or is it specifically people who dealt with Edison? I mean, where does the supply chain, if you will, go?
No, and that's a great question, and it's murky. The Edison was used for 12 types of tests, tests like a pregnancy test and a test for prostate-specific antigen, which is something that you monitor to see if you have prostate cancer. All I think they're being told right now is they're receiving a report, or they're being informed by their doctor that they've received a report with a voided result.
Just to be clear about what was so whiz-bang about these Edison machines and Theranos' big selling point, I guess, it was basically that they could do it with a drop of blood. You didn't have to do like 5 test tubes full.
That's right. The claim to fame of Theranos and what was advertised on their website were breakthrough advancements that made it possible for the company to run the full range of laboratory tests on just a drop of blood.
What does this, what do the troubles that Theranos is having say about life as a biotech or a biomedical startup? Is it necessarily tougher because the stakes are so high? Is that what's going on? Or is it just don't falsify your results?
Well, Theranos had styled itself as a tech company and as a very much a Silicon Valley company. And Elizabeth Holmes wore and I think still wears black turtlenecks.
Yep.
And that, you know, reminds us of Steve Jobs. And it was applying the Silicon Valley tech playbook to this new arena, which is blood testing. The problem is blood testing is medicine. And, you know, blood tests are used by doctors all the time, doctors and patients together, to make important medical decisions. So you can't really experiment with blood tests or put out blood tests that are just, you know, a version that you're still working on in the way that you would get out a version of your latest Twitter or smartphone app.
John Carreyrou is an investigative reporter at The Wall Street Journal, writing again today about some of the trouble Theranos finds itself in. John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Three years and $305 million later, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art opened its post-renovation doors this past weekend. It's the biggest modern and contemporary art museum in North America, and its overhaul came amid a decade of growth in the number and emphasis of museums focusing on this kind of art. The Whitney launched its brand new space in New York last year. The Met, also in New York, has its own modern and contemporary outpost. But as museums move from the past to works of present day, there are some new issues to deal with, many of them centered around the good old American dollar. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
Lucy Mitchell Innes runs the Mitchell Innes and Nash Gallery. It's a prestigious art gallery of contemporary and modern art in New York. And this curious thing started happening about 10 years ago. It still happens today.
A letter came across my desk yesterday morning. They were asking for $10,000.
The letter was from a museum putting on an exhibit of one of the artists Mitchell Innes represents, asking her to chip in.
It can be $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, and can be more.
15 years ago, this would have been unheard of.
And they said, oh, no, that we want separation of church and state.
That separation is fading. Museums are focusing on contemporary art more than ever before, and the artwork is expensive to buy and install. So they ask for help from the people who stand to gain, artists and galleries.
Honestly, museums are pretty both greedy and cash-strapped right now, a lot of them.
Kelly Crow covers art for the Wall Street Journal. Museums sometimes ask not just for money, but for donations of art.
Otherwise, they may not be able to afford it.
Catherine Mikkelsen is a professor of art history at the Fashion Institute of Technology.
Boundaries are being blurred.
One concern is that museums in need of funds might be influenced in their exhibitions by galleries who supply them.
It's problematic to have a museum so blatantly involved in promoting an artist whose works are for sale.
On the other hand, it's kind of unavoidable that museums showing contemporary art are going to be exhibiting artists who are still alive and still selling their sometimes very expensive work.
No question, it's fraught with challenges.
Maxwell Anderson is a research affiliate at Princeton and former director of the Whitney and the Dallas Museum of Art. He says an experienced curator with a reputation to preserve should be able to manage conflicts of interest. He does worry about smaller institutions, though, with less scrutiny or less experienced curators.
The ultimate cure-all in the art world, since the art world is unregulated, is transparency.
Transparency helps because conflicts of interest, like beauty and art, are often in the eye of the beholder. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
If you're an art fan, or even if you're not, actually, you're going to want to check out the latest episode of our podcast, Actuality, hosted by Sabri and Quartz's Tim Fernholz. It's all about how contemporary art is reshaping the museum world. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up.
It's something familiar, and I feel like there are people on the show that I know.
I know, me too! The legacy of Grey's Anatomy. But first, let's do the numbers. I do watch, actually. The Dow Industrial's down 91 points today, 0.5% to close at 17,435. What do you think of me now, right? The NASDAQ fell 26 points, about 0.5%, 4712. The S&P 500 declined 7 points, about 1/3%, 2040. Wall Street's a bit glum about the possibility of a Fed rate increase in June, and banks that rose yesterday on the prospect of being able to charge more interest settled down today. J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America both gave back about 1% today. As we mentioned, Walmart's earnings suggest consumers are still trolling the grocery aisles. Walmart bagged 9.5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.84%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The buzz in television land this week with the advertising upfronts going on in New York has been all about the spiffy new shows that are coming to us. We, however, are going to reserve a moment here for the oldies but the goodies, the almost ancient, really, by network standards. Grey's Anatomy, the show that made Shonda Rhimes into Shonda Rhimes, wraps up its 12th season tonight on ABC. And not only is it on track to finish as the network's number one drama among advertisers' favorite people, that'd be 18 to 49-year-olds, but it is also ABC's second most watched series overall this season behind Dancing with the Stars. So, who then to thank for Grey's long-running success? Marketplace's Adrian Hill is on that one.
It's a rare network drama that stays on top as long as Grey's.
Seriously?
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 One reason, fans like Emily Patinos.
It's also sort of everyone's guilty pleasure.
She's 23 and has been watching Grey's on and off for years. She says in college,
I had a roommate in my dorm room and I would kind of hide it from her. I would like watch it late at night or when she wasn't in the room. And then it turned out that she was doing the same thing.
They started watching together. Now she's getting her MFA in a new city and watching again.
It's something familiar, and I feel like there are people on the show that I know.
It's comforting.
I love you, Meredith Grey, and I want to spend the rest of my life with you.
Legions of Emily Patinos out there have discovered Meredith, Derek, and the other doctors at Seattle Grace on streaming services. Patrick Moran is executive vice president at ABC Studios.
A lot of these viewers, you know, if they're in high school, were barely watching television when the show started.
ABC says viewing of the pilot episode has doubled in the last 5 years. And nearly 40% of viewers who streamed the show last summer started watching the show this fall.
People can come in, discover the show, binge on the previous 11 seasons, then catch up on season 12.
More live viewers means more ad revenue. Ad Age estimates Grey's pulled in about $160,000 per 30-second spot this season, up from last year. Not quite scandal territory. It's in the $200,000 range, but still a top 20 earner. Amanda Lotz is a communication studies professor at the University of Michigan. She says the kind of shift we're seeing with Grey's is still new.
We don't have that long of a history with the possibility of moving audiences in this way.
She says Breaking Bad remains one of the best examples of what's been called the Netflix effect, moving people who discover a show late into the real-time audience.
Its live audience grew season to season, which really wasn't a phenomenon that people had seen before.
But the success of these shows on streaming services and the increasing value of their multi-season libraries raises a thorny question for networks and cable.
Whether they are going to continue to let Netflix be the middleman.
Jennifer Holt teaches media industry studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She says networks and cable channels have been working on their own streaming platforms and sees Netflix's investment in original programming as a recognition of where things are headed.
They see the writing on the wall that they're going to start to be cut out as that middleman, and they need to start branding and developing their own content to survive in this marketplace.
For now, the relationship between Netflix and broadcasters is mutually beneficial, kind of like friends with benefits, but not nearly as inevitable and unreserved as Meredith's love for McDreamy.
Pick me. Choose me. Love me.
I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
A couple of years ago, our China correspondent, Rob Schmitz, did a series of stories about pollution in that country. Pollution in the air, in the ground, and in the water. A government report not too long ago, a Chinese government report to be clear, showed 80% of underground water there is too toxic to drink. So Rob revisits his series now from a village in central China.
3 years ago, I sat beside the bed of Zhang Rinxiang as the 42-year-old lay dying of uterine cancer. She and dozens of others here in Liuchong Village in Hubei Province have petitioned China's government and complained on state-run television that they've been poisoned by Dasheng Chemical, a company that manufactures phosphate fertilizer on a hill above the village. 2 days after I visited Zhang, she died. She's buried here on a hillside above the village. Spring rain from low dark clouds overhead soaked the terrace plots of bright yellow rapeseed surrounding her grave.
She was a good person, very outgoing.
Xu Huiping stands with an umbrella, bowing to her friend's tomb. The two belong to the same village farming collective. Xu walks across the hillside to the next hill. Nothing grows on top of this one.
This is where they dumped the phosphogypsum. You see the gray ash underneath the topsoil here? That's why nothing will ever grow here.
Phosphogypsum is a byproduct of making fertilizer. It's radioactive, and according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, it contains cancer-causing chemicals like arsenic, uranium, and radium. That's why the agency has prohibited the use of it in the U.S. A 200-foot-high hill of phosphogypsum ash looms over Liuchong Village, a stark whitish-gray peak that grows taller each day as Dasheng Chemical's trucks unload more ash on top of it. When the wind blows, the radioactive ash falls like fine snow over the village. And when it rains, its toxic chemicals seep into the ground. Tests of the water in this village, funded by the European Union, show arsenic levels nearly 200 times what China considers safe. Levels of fluoride are 900 times higher than the national standard.
All this pollution is illegal, but what can we do? We're just ordinary people, and we're stuck here.
A doctor who is assigned to treat patients here calls the village hopeless.
Our only hope is that journalists get the word out. Living here is a death sentence.
3 years ago, state-run CCTV, China's most popular television news organization, broadcast a half-hour documentary about the health problems of villagers here. The report said back then, 20 villagers had died of cancer, likely caused by Dasheng's pollution. This doctor says out of 300 villagers who live near Dasheng Chemical's factory, she's now lost 30 to cancer, and five more will likely die soon.
Patients come to see me every day because they feel weak and dizzy. I estimate 80 to 90% of the people in this village are suffering from low white blood cell counts or anemia.
She's agreed to speak for this report as long as her name isn't used because she says Dasheng Chemical's owner, a man named Zhong Shoubin, has threatened villagers to not talk to outsiders about his company's pollution.
He has told us that if we say anything bad about his company, he'll have us killed.
CCTV's 2013 documentary featured a villager who said Dasheng's owner threatened to have her run over by a truck. Others Marketplace interviewed say they, too, have witnessed these threats. But it hasn't stopped villagers, some dying of cancer, from traveling to Beijing to petition China's central government to clean up the pollution. That hasn't worked either, says villager Tian Fuxue.
They sent us to a local police station, detained us, and then our local government officials picked us up and promised to compensate us, but nobody's ever cleaned up this mess.
Marketplace contacted Dasheng Chemical owner Zhong Shoubin. He refused an interview. We also contacted several local officials. None of them answered our interview requests.
Personally, I think that Dasheng Chemical obtained a free pass from the provincial government and the Environmental Protection Bureau.
Li Jun is the former village chief of Liuchong. He says he was fired because he allowed too many of his villagers to petition to Beijing. I spoke to him in 2013 while he took care of his father, who was dying of cancer.
As the former leader of this village, I feel ashamed. Our villagers are telling the truth, and I have appealed to my superiors many times. But nothing has ever been done to stop the pollution.
Interview requests to both the Hubei provincial government and China's Ministry of Environmental Protection went unanswered.
Water pollution is a severe problem in China, especially in rural areas.
Jiang Wenlai is a researcher at the Chinese Academy of Agricultural Sciences in Beijing.
If this cannot be solved, it will do enormous damage to China's economy. But the government is now starting to pay a lot of attention to the environmental problems in rural China.
Zhang and other scientists in Beijing are encouraged by China's new Minister of Environmental Protection, Chen Jining. Since the former water expert took his position 3 years ago, he's encouraged citizens to document water pollution via social media and report it to authorities. He's also vowed to get tough on polluters. But so far, these new efforts have been aimed at the wealthy class in urban China, and polluted Liuchong Village is far from Beijing. After years of protesting in front of county government offices, the local government finally agreed to begin piping cleaner drinking water to villagers. The new water comes from the nearby Han River, a waterway that, according to China's top hydrologist, has been increasingly prone to pollution since part of it was diverted to Beijing in 2014 to solve that city's water shortage. Xu Huiping says the county government asked each villager to pay the equivalent of $300, more than a month's salary, to pay for the new water.
The government should pay for it, and the factory should pay even more for it. We shouldn't have to pay. They polluted our water.
Better drinking water came too late for Zhang Rinxiang, whose rain-soaked grave overlooks the village where she used to live, and beyond that, hills of radioactive ash. Her friend Xu Huiping points to her tomb.
Her name isn't on the tombstone yet. It's our custom to wait 3 years. The anniversary will be here soon, and her name will be etched into the stone.
And when it is, the death of the latest villager in Liuchong to succumb to cancer will be official. In Liuchong Village, Hubei Province, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the death of a storyteller. Longtime CBS News correspondent Morley Safer died this morning. And when I say long time, I mean 52 years, 46 of them at 60 Minutes. He talked to just about everybody, about just about everything, including after Bernie Madoff was sentenced to 150 years in prison for running the biggest Ponzi scheme anybody's ever seen. He talked to Madoff's wife, Ruth.
It's really hard for people to believe that you didn't know, that you must have known.
I can't explain it. I mean, I trusted him.
Used to watch Morley Safer every Sunday night. When I was a kid, he was 84 years old when he died. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks for listening to this Marketplace podcast. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. So here's some context on us. We're a nonprofit service, and we rely on donations from our listeners to keep on going. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. So please, donate today at marketplace.org. Okay, got to go. The Dow off 91 points today, 0.5%. The S&P 500 off 7 points, about 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 26 points, about 0.5% there. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.